So thank you for tuning in to York's Political Mashup. I'm presenting this show in somewhat changed and more uncertain times. I must emphasise that before we start to untangle the political intricacies involved in the coronavirus, that as we're living in a very uncertain and evolving pandemic, the main purpose of this next hour of debate is to ensure that the political debate isn't stifled in these dark times. With us, we have political representatives from all over the country. We have members from the Conservative Party, the Labour Party, and independent candidates. So we have Harry from the Conservative Party's Conservative Chair.
Hello, nice to be here.
And Harry, where are you from at the moment? Where are you staying at the moment?
I'm at home in Liverpool.
Okay, and we have William Bentley from the Labour Party.
Hiya, I'm just staying at home right at the moment down in Berkshire, so yeah, it's quiet down here.
Okay, and we have Nathan Rowland, an independent.
Hi, thanks for having me.
And we have Francesca, an independent as well, who's been on the show before.
Hi, glad to be here again.
Okay, so we're going to start off by speaking about the problems that the coronavirus has brought up for personal freedoms versus the state's duty to protect lives. So we're going to start off by looking at Lord Sumption's comments. So I think the best place to start with is Harry, who's the Conservative Party chairman. Harry, what do you make of Lord Sumption's belief that the coronavirus has created a collective hysteria and that people have been too willing to surrender their freedom in return for protection against what he calls some external threat?
So having gone through the coronavirus bill, there will certainly be limitations to our freedoms, which we enjoy on a daily basis. However, during these difficult times, it is imperative that we reduce the spread of the virus in order to ensure the health service can cope with the capacity. So in my opinion, one of the main functions of any government is to protect its people. And at the moment, we have to protect our people. And the way we're going to do that is by enforcing lockdown, ensure that we have the legislation in place and we give the correct powers to the NHS and to our police force to ensure that they are able to do so. So even though for a short amount of time we will have limited freedoms, I think it's important that our main objective at the moment is to save as many lives as possible.
I mean, there's been much criticism of Derbyshire Police Force for what Lord Sumption has described as shaming people for going and taking their one daily exercise. I mean, do you think that the police have they been acting inappropriately upon their increased powers, would you say, or are people just not exercising common sense?
I don't think people are exercising common sense, to be perfectly honest with you, because when you go out for your one exercise a day, it's still important that you follow social distancing rules. So when I go for runs at night, I always make sure if I'm going to run past somebody that I stay 2 meters apart. And that's vitally important to reduce the spread of the virus. And the police are in a difficult situation as well, because they're currently facing a difficult situation because a lot of their staff are off with the virus or with symptoms of the virus. So I don't think it's fair to be giving too much criticism to the police force at the moment, but they're in a difficult situation as well. But I think what the public need to do is just to exercise some basic common sense. If we follow the rules and we follow them well, it means we can get a lockdown sooner and ordinary normal life can resume as soon as possible.
Okay, let's bring in William. William, what do you think about the coronavirus Act of 2020 and its implications for personal freedoms? I mean, the civil liberties group Big Brother has described it as one of the most draconian powers in peacetime Britain.
Well, I think there's a large part of it where, to a certain extent, I do agree with Barry that people do need to enforce these restrictions to save as many lives as possible. And I think certainly it'd be dishonest to imply that there wasn't the best intentions behind these policies. I don't think the government is attempting to impose some sort of grand police state on us, but at the same time, I feel this bill is being used to enforce, in some ways, abuses, particularly within the police force. So Derbyshire Police, as mentioned in Lord Sumption's article, have been abusing and what I describe as harassing certain people and have been allowed these powers under this bill. So I think there should be more detail and more review into the implications of the bill. And in terms of the generic premise of attempting to save as many lives as possible, I think it comes with the best of intentions.
I mean, the government has promised to look at the bill every 6 months in terms of the powers it gives to the police, and they have said that it's only meant to be last 2 years. Do you think that there's sufficient protections against this bill becoming what you sort of labelled as the dangers of a police state?
I think certain protections, if implemented, would do well, but I think the bigger issue is that there isn't enough, and I think the assumption describes as an environment of certain mass hysteria. People aren't being realistic about the implications of the bill and analysing it for themselves, so it may not be the public outcry that such a bill potentially deserves. Obviously, I don't think the powers themselves in principle are wrong, but far rather, it's the fact that the abuses that may come with it aren't being investigated or paid attention to. So I think some sort of rewritings and alterations of the bill would be in order to sort of enforce a more priority to people. And I think that would help the lockdown entirely, because it would have a certain level of clearness of the situation.
I mean, as a representative of the Labour Party, I mean, the Act doesn't contain certain protections for striking, which the Civil Contingencies Act of 2004 did. So it doesn't allow political protest. Are you worried about these, or would you say that that's expected when you have a national emergency of this scale?
Well, I imagine the larger issue of allowing public protest would be the fact that it would break social distancing guidelines, and at the time it is important to save as many lives as possible. So to that extent, I would be critical to the implications of banning strikes and political protests, but at the same time, at first glance, that seems to be an appropriate response in terms of preventing mass gatherings in public.
Okay, let's go to Francesca. Francesca, what do you think about Lord Sumption's comments?
I don't agree that there's mass hysteria in the country. I think, if anything, some people aren't taking it seriously enough. And there's tons of people who haven't been observing social distancing. And there's a lot of people who don't seem to understand that whatever situation you're in, you need to physically distance. I mean, they've been called out to, the Manchester police have had to go out to nearly like 200 house parties. So while I think it's important that we challenge and we question our institutions, and I do think the police should be subject to scrutiny when they've got these new powers, I don't personally think in general they cross the line, because we do need to make sure that we save as many lives as possible.
Yeah, I mean, the government has said over the weekend that they were ordering the creation of an NHS mobile phone app. And the former head of MI5 has said that that has serious implications for personal privacy. Would you be comfortable with giving over personal data towards this app? Or do you think that there has to be a certain transparency in terms of its use?
I think that's a very, very good question. And I definitely think that we should be worried. We should think about how much data we're giving to people. But at the same time, we already give up so much data about ourselves. I mean, I think with the Cambridge Analytica case, it came out that using sort of social media habits, by analysing them and analysing browsing habits, and you can create psychological profiles of people. And yeah, I don't know if the question is that we can, I don't think we can avoid things like this, like health apps, necessarily. We're seeing a movement towards wider use of technology, and there are massive, massive benefits of it. I think what we need to question is how robust it is. I don't think the app is the problem or the social distancing measures are the problem. I think we just need to make sure that our data is protected and encrypted when we do use technology or when we do give the police and institutions extra powers.
Okay, let's go to you, Nathan. Nathan, the government has said that it's going to do whatever it takes when it comes to tackling the coronavirus. Is this necessarily a good thing if it means the abrogation of people's personal freedoms and privacy?
Well, I think, especially in relation to the ever-mentioned Derbyshire police incident, I think what you've got to bear in mind is that although people are describing these as a reduction in our civil liberties and freedom, you've got to look at the wider implications of the reasons behind this. Now, for instance, although I don't fully agree with the public shaming of dog walkers in parks in Derbyshire, you've got to bear in mind that if you're allowing citizens to drive several miles from their home, they could be spreading the virus. So whilst, yes, it might at first seem over the top, when you analyse it, you then do see there is actually a reason behind this. So I think, and also you've got to bear in mind in relation to PPE, for instance. So there have been several reports of police officers having incidents where they've been coughed at or spat at by members of the public who are refusing to adhere to the social distancing guidelines. And so I think when your main aim as a country is to save and protect lives, I think the measures that have been put in place are perfectly justifiable.
I mean, I think Lord Sumption's concerns in the article in which he was speaking were more long-term rather than short-term, in the sense that he has fears that there will be the codification of certain powers which the government will then be allowed to use after the virus is less of a threat to civil society. Do you think that that is a genuine threat, or do you think that the government will not act irresponsibly upon these increased powers?
No, I don't really think that's a threat in the long term. I mean, with the six-month review proposals, and I think even the Liberal Democrats leader Davey was asking for a three-month review, I don't think there's really the potential for long-term abuses in relation to the Act.
Okay.
I'm going to say, could I come in there?
Yep.
I was going to say, we've seen much more extensive powers in place. I mean, albeit like 70 years ago, but after World War II and the First World War, like the police, we didn't have a police state after that, and the powers were far more extensive. You had things like the Official Secrets Act, and that didn't have that effect. So yeah, I agree, and I really doubt that this act will lead to a police state or will lead to institutions being granted unnecessary powers.
And of course, Tony Blair also brought it. He also brought in legislation to tackle terrorism, which gave the state quite far-reaching powers. So I suppose that could support. Yeah.
I just think, in terms of the risks of what Lord Sumption is proposing, I think far less of the issue is a police state in terms of, you know, a material form, but far rather that we're allowing ourselves to be psychologically subjective to things which the Derbyshire police have been accused of. So drones being used to shame dog walkers, that sort of thing, people having their photos uploaded online even though they have not technically been breaking the rules. And I think Sumption's wider point is that we're allowing ourselves to be reduced to this state and essentially be abused by the police force because of such psychological fear. Not that psychological fear is unplaced, but maybe it is being exploited in some way.
We mentioned the Derbyshire police. Do you think that the occasions in which it's being exploited take place within a minority of places around the country, or would you say that it's probably likely that this abuse is prevalent?
Well, I think it's impossible to quantify that, and I think that as it stands right now, we simply don't know. I think a lot of people have been abiding these laws, so as it stands right now, the police do not have much to do. And I think in some parts of the country, particularly where I am right now, I am still seeing large gatherings, and I think the police should clamp down on that. But rather, I think that the usage by Derbyshire police alone highlight a potential long-term danger of this. So I think currently it's less of a pressing issue right now, but it does stoke some sort of alarmist tendencies.
Okay. Does anyone have anything else to say?
I was going to say, could I briefly come in? I completely get your point, and I do think that the Derbyshire police incident was slightly worrying, even if they were right to tell people not to walk there. But that received a massive, massive backlash. I actually think sort of the bigger danger is ourselves. I mean, we've seen examples of NHS workers and people who moved into like Airbnbs and hotels because they have to self-isolate. We've seen examples of them getting threatening notes from neighbours. And I think sort of the psychological, I think this is definitely having a psychological effect on us, but I think actually it's more ourselves, it's more us who are the problem rather than the police, because they're subject to massive scrutiny.
Yeah, so it's more lack of self-discipline, would you say? Would you say it's more lack of self-discipline on the part of the public then?
Sort of, but also that I think that as a sort of negative force, and I think that sort of vigilante action is a bigger concern than the sort of police over the police's powers over action.
Yeah. Does anyone have anything else to say before we go on to the topic of testing?
Could I just come back in on the NHS mobile app?
Okay.
So as my understanding goes, it's there's actually not much of an issue with personal data, as I think the app is meant to use Bluetooth, and so it won't actually store any personal information. But I think the bigger risk running with the app is the potential for false reports. So if you have some idiots who think it's fun to say they have symptoms or have had the virus when they haven't, you then run the risk of a greater chance of there being hysteria if you get a greater increase in potential reported cases.
Yeah. Okay, we're gonna move on to testing now. So I think we'll go back to Harry, as we haven't heard from him in a while. Harry, Matt Hancock has set the target of 100,000 tests a day by the end of April. At the moment, currently, they're around between 10,000 to 20,000 tests a day being conducted. I believe today there was around 18,000 tests conducted. Do you think the 100,000 target is realistic, considering the number of tests that's being carried out at the moment?
I certainly think it'll be a difficult target to reach, but it's not impossible though. And I think what's really important to consider when you're talking about testing is you've got to consider four elements to successful testing. So first of all, you've got to consider laboratory space, and that's something which Germany have succeeded on really well. You need the right kind of machine so they can test for the coronavirus, COVID-19, as well as having the right substances to extract the virus's genetic material and specialised staff. So regarding the 100,000 tests a day, one thing that the UK is doing at the moment, and I've advocated for quite a while ago, is the UK government has got to work with the large pharmaceutical and biomedical industry, because if we can use their capacity, it means that we could potentially reach the 100,000 tests a day. So the other day, Dr. Rupert Beale, who works at the Francis Crick Institute, came out saying the 100,000 target a day is certainly possible. And if the government work together and work with the private industry, they can certainly achieve that. The other day, Matt Hancock also secured a big deal with pharmaceutical giants GlaxoSmithKline and AstraZeneca in order to reach the target. So I think it's absolutely imperative that we work with the private sector. And as the chief executive of the NHS said the other day, he came out talking about it almost being a Dunkirk effort. So we have quite a few small laboratories in the UK in which we've got to try and turn them into the suitable facilities to test for COVID-19. So it's going to require a big effort. It's going to be difficult, but I certainly think we can do it though.
Okay, thank you. Now, let's go to William. William, what do you think about the target? And is it worrying that Germany at the start of April were already conducting up to 50,000 tests a day.
Well, I think what we have to remember in terms of Germany is that Germany has a farly different structured health system towards us. They, because they are a federal country, have a far more federalised health system, and intervention. It is based far more around a sort of state insurance hybrid system which allows you to see results very quickly. Not like we have a better system to us, but I think it's unfair to compare ourselves to them when they use an entirely different model. As in terms of the 100,000 testing goal, I think it's obviously the right goal to attempt to achieve in terms of getting as many NHS staff back on the front lines as quickly as possible. But I think the greater question is time span. And in terms of dealing with these private companies to achieve this, I feel there may be bureaucratic restrictions which may limit the extent that we reach this 100,000 target. And at that point, as more people target, that 100,000 target may seem far, far more unsatisfying to general public. So I think that's what has to be taken in regard.
Okay, thank you, William. Francesca, what do you make of our efforts so far to reach that 100,000 target?
I certainly think, I'm glad to hear that they're going to work with private companies. It's absolutely needed. I hope it's achievable, because it will make a massive difference to our response if we can reach it. I think I've heard that we have enough tests for NHS staff to be tested when they feel they need now, which is very, very good. I think that we need to know who's had it, and hopefully the 100,000 target will allow for community testing and will allow us to sort of learn more about it and learn more about where we are in sort of the virus point, well, where we are in the pandemic. And I think that'll be important for helping us come out of it.
One of the Matt Hancock has set out a 5-pillar plan, and one of the main objectives of the plan, he talks about building a diagnostics industry to reach this 100,000 target, and that's received a lot of criticism. Like, for example, Keith Plum from the a member of the Institution of Chemical Engineers has said that setting up what appears to be effectively a new industry within the UK in such a short amount of time doesn't really appear practical. Do you think there's enough realism in terms of the strategy that the government's undertaking, or is that not too much of a concern? Because it's better that we'd rather be over-ambitious than not doing enough to tackle the virus.
I mean, yeah, I agree with that. It's far better to try and do as much as you can. Normally, yes, you wouldn't think that it'd be possible to set up an industry in such short time. But we are in a time of crisis. Our economy is already been completely upturned. And yeah, if we've got spare capacity, why not use it to try and get ourselves out of the crisis, particularly since most of the nations in the world have to focus on themselves. And unfortunately, the tests we're seeing come in from China, an incredible number are faulty. And even the other countries who are nearing, who could maybe provide them, and even the ones who have the most effective response are still trying to respond, countries like Japan and South Korea. So we need to do this ourselves. No one else is going to do it for us.
Okay, let's bring in Nathan. Nathan, do you think the Conservatives have set themselves up for failure with this 100,000 target, or would you echo more the comments of Harry, for example, on the fact that, you know, Matthew Hancock has actually been speaking to these big private organisations in order to meet the target?
Well, I think it comes down to, with 100,000 testing per day, I think it comes down to how you are categorising the testing. For instance, you have the swab tests, which actually test if you have the virus, and then you have the antibody test to see if you have had the virus. Now, there isn't often much differentiation between the two tests, and they're often lumped into the same category. Now, I believe the government bought options on 17 million of the antibody testing. So, yes, theoretically, it's possible for them to fulfill their target of 100,000 tests per day, but whether it all depends on what percentage of that are antibody tests and what percentage of that are swab tests. But in relation to the government's handling with the pharmaceutical industry, I know there have been a lot of universities who have been offering up their labs but have had a lack of information or direction from the government as to what they can do, in the sense that they're willing and able to help, but their capacity to do so hasn't really been brought into focus.
I mean, Harry, are you there?
Yeah.
Yep. What would you make of the comments of, for example, like those of Nathan's, who has said that there's been plenty of labs that have offered their help but haven't received a response from the government?
Well, I think what I would say to that is, first of all, we're working on it. As someone pointed out before, that we've just bought a large amount of tests. So we've got the antibody test and we've got the swab test. So I think the government at the moment are also trying to work out which one's more effective. They'll use both for testing. So at the moment, the government are working with large industries and large companies to ensure that they can get the correct amount of laboratories so they can go ahead and try and meet with their target, but also working with universities as well. But at the moment, I think the government are more focusing on the large pharmaceutical giants, because in terms of increasing capacity significantly, that's where we can increase it very quickly. Whereas I think with universities, yes, we can increase the capacity, but not as much as in terms of working with pharmaceutical giants.
Okay, let's move on to talking about the economic impact of the virus, which is so important, as well as the political and social impact. So let's go to William. William, what do you make of the government's loan scheme for businesses and the government's decision to give an unprecedented amount of 80% of people's salaries as long as companies don't lay off their workers?
I mean, I think any measures are welcome at this point. I'll take anything, genuinely. I think all of these measures are very helpful to working people, but there are still a large amount of missed areas. For example, Rishi Sunak as Chancellor still hasn't announced anything which would help people who have only recently gained employment. They struggle to qualify for these credits, and many of them are only applied towards the beginning of May and June. So many people will be going without pay, and at a large time like this, landlords are demanding rent, which people are simply unable to pay for. In terms of the business side, I think a large amount of the business loans the banks are providing have really hoops to jump through. Also, with the demands of collateral to provide for these businesses in the face of receiving these loans, many may come out of this worse, especially with the impending recession that such has come out of this.
Yeah.
So in some ways, I think that the government's measures may do more harm than good when applied to the business side. But I think, as it stands now, the concept of loans to help businesses through this tough period, provided they are of low interest and do not have such demands for collateral and bureaucratic systems to apply for them, they are a welcome measure.
I mean, the loan scheme which the government has set up, Sunak's reviewing, because only 1% of applications were processed as of Sunday. And Lord King, who was a former head of the Bank of England during the 2008 recession, said that something has clearly gone wrong. What do you think that the problem with the government's strategy in terms of businesses is that the actual substance of the measures is right, but the actual application of them has been ineffective?
Well, I think the large issue with the applications is not taking into the fact that we are in a time of crisis, and many of the people applying for loans at this time will not be able to jump through the hoops in time before they are facing bankruptcy. So I think right now there needs to be a complete review of the way in which these loans are being distributed, the way in which the administration is handling and distributing money, and being able to effectively assert that this business will be able to receive a loan at a far faster rate. Because the longer the government is, the more people will be unemployed, and the less the impending recession will be. So essentially it's a question of, well, not just cutting red tape, but also completely reviewing the manner in which image structure is essentially coalescing around these things.
I mean, let's go to Francesca. Francesca, do you think that the banks, on top of what we discussed about the loan scheme for businesses, are they doing enough? Because there's been reports that they're charging companies double-digit interest rates, and they've been demanding personal guarantees in order to give out loans.
I think there's definitely been a lot of banks that haven't responded well. I mean, I know that there are some banks who are suspending mortgage payments and things like that, which is very, very good. But definitely, there's always businesses that are seeking to profit here, and some of the banks are doing that. Charging double-digit interest is ridiculous, and there are loads of supermarkets that are upping food prices and things like that. I think the businesses that are still functioning, I definitely think some of them are taking advantage of their customers. And I was going to say, I don't know how the government would tackle that, and maybe they could introduce legislation that sort of means businesses and banks can't profit it and can't raise their prices too high.
Nathan, in terms of the government's response to the economic impact of this crisis, I mean, it's what it's pledged so far to pay 80% of the salaries of workers, which works out to roughly a maximum of 2,500, is very in line with what other countries have done. For example, Denmark has promised to pay 75% of workers' wages, and then the US has also decided to give direct cash payments. Do you think that the government can be criticised for their response in terms of the fact that what they're pledging to do is unprecedented in British political history?
I think, as we've heard quite a lot, is that the government's willing to do whatever it takes. And I think the steps and measures it has taken so far have certainly done a huge amount for people. But as is always going to be the case, you're going to have people falling through the cracks. And I know, for instance, with the self-employed, there are certain requirements, for instance, having to have worked 3 years and having to have a turnover of 50,000 to be able to apply for that £30,000 grant. But I think if there is any criticism towards the government in this, in relation to this, they could get around with it by, I mean, I know they announced £750 million for charities, but would be to increase local funding for councils and charities. So for that small minority that do fall through the net, they would be there to catch them, so to speak. But other than that, no, I think the government has done pretty well given the crisis we find ourselves in.
What would you say in response to the Institute for Fiscal Studies said that the package which they've put in place actually encourages businesses to temporarily lay off staff because they furlough half of them and then keep half of them on full time?
So is that, are you saying then that it's better to furlough or to lay off staff?
I'm not saying either, but the Institute of Fiscal Studies have said that the actual package which the government has put in place actually encourages businesses to actually lay off half of their staff and then keep half of them.
I think consequences like that are going to be necessary because as long as this lockdown's in place, there's only so much small businesses can do. A lot of the gig economy and restaurants, for instance, they don't necessarily have the financial capacity to be able to furlough all of their staff for the period of time that the lockdown lasts. So
yeah.
I think it's an inevitable consequence.
Okay, Harry, let's bring you in on this discussion finally. I mean, you know, the Institute of Fiscal Studies have said that, you know, the package was designed in haste. Isn't that kind of that was inevitable, wasn't it? It was an unavoidable thing that this economic package had to be quickly prepared.
Yes, I completely agree. So if someone had said to me back in November or December that the UK and all of Europe and majority of the world would go in lockdown, you would have laughed and think it would never happen at all. And I think the way the government reacted has been exceptional. So as everyone's rightly pointed out, we've made an initial £330 billion of guarantees, which is equivalent to 15% of GDP. We've got the coronavirus job retention scheme, which HMRC were paying up to 80% of everyone's wages, up to a maximum of £2,500. But also there's other financial measures which we've put in place to help people. So wiping off the NHS debt of £13.4 billion is really important, so the NHS can focus on frontline work and less so on the administration. But also the self-employed income support scheme, which will pay up to 80% of people's average monthly profits for 3 years, up to £2,500. And I think that's a really important scheme as well, because when I'm back home, I work for quite a lot of self-employed people. I'm a building site, and a lot of people have said to me the scheme's a really good scheme. It's going to help people out a lot. And then just to finish it off, we've got the £750 million allocation of funds to help to support charities so that they can continue their vital work. So as someone rightly pointed out, you know, if someone does fall through, there is a safety net there because the charities are there also helping out. But I've been exceptionally impressed of how quickly they've been able to set this up. So I've mentioned before, but I'll say it again, you know, being a former civil servant, I worked last year in delivering large technology projects within government. I worked and there are so many difficulties you have to face. You know, the EU settlement scheme, even though it was for EU citizens, that's 3 million. So compared to the scheme that they've just set up now, you can't compare it. To set up the EU settlement scheme took years. There are so many regulations, international law you've got to consider, GDPR, you know, people's data, and also something that people never take into consideration, have the staff got the right training? And this is why it's so difficult. So people can moan saying, oh, it's not good enough here, it's not good enough there. You know, how the government have set this scheme up, and so many other schemes, so the job retention scheme and the business loan scheme, has been nothing short of incredible, because people really take consideration how difficult it is to set up a large technology project, and especially in such a small amount of time. So I think the reaction of the government has been exceptional.
Okay, thank you. Right, we're now going to move on to the case of the actual operation of the government and its inner workings. So let's start with Francesca on this one. Francesca, do you think that Dominic Raab needs to be given more powers by the Prime Minister in the sense to actually lead the coronavirus response?
Maybe, but I guess I don't think that's the biggest issue. I think currently, I think what they need to get done, they will need to get done. They've done so far. Hopefully Boris will be able to come back pretty soon. But I think, yeah, I think if they need to give Raab more powers, I think he will get them straight away.
Because Keir Starmer has said, the new Labour leader has called for it to be clear who's actually in charge while Johnson is recuperating, because there has been reports that there's been tensions in the cabinet and that Raab can only make a decision once there's collective agreement from the cabinet. But are you suggesting that maybe that's not necessarily necessary, in the sense that the cabinet are receiving their instructions from Johnson and these aren't really details they're going to argue about?
Basically. I don't think that's a fair criticism from Starmer. I mean, the cabinet's always been like that. It's primus inter pares, and they're supposed to be equal, and it's supposed to have collective agreement. Everyone's supposed to agree that they can take responsibility for it. I think it's mostly the media who are saying that there's sort of massive disagreements going on.
Okay. Yeah, let's bring in William. William, firstly, who did you vote for in the Labour leadership, if you don't mind me asking?
My first preference was Keir Starmer, and he won, obviously, and my second preference was Lisa Nandy.
Okay, so in terms of this question, I think what it gets to the heart of is accountability and who takes responsibility. Would you, do you think that you share Keir Starmer's concern that at the moment it isn't necessarily clear to the public who's actually in charge and leading the response in cabinet?
I think there could be some more clarity and transparency from the government. I don't think it has to necessarily translate to emergency powers that would not normally be given to an acting minister in the case of Dominic Raab. But I think some more transparency as to how decisions are being made and processed, rather than being essentially shrouded, would be very valuable to the public in feeling safe and feeling as though there is proper leadership in this time. And I think that would help people's confidence a lot more in this period. And obviously, the question is, what does the government have to hide about how decisions are being made? I also think that the bigger issue when it comes to this is the government's refusal to discuss things about its future planning, which does make me think that there are disagreements in cabinet. So the question of an exit strategy, for example, I think would do very well to enforce lockdown and save lives if people had a clear plan as to how things were going to be lifted and in what order, not necessarily a date, because the government can't commit to that, obviously, but some more communication from the government beyond daily briefings in which a lot of the information is often repeated would be very clear. I think there is an issue of the government somewhat being rather condescending and patronising its daily briefings. I don't disagree with the concept of daily briefings, but I think they could do far more to be open and communicate with the public and commit to mistakes.
In what way do you think they've been patronising?
So I feel the way in which they've been patronising is that they have not clearly published an exit strategy. I'm not expecting a full exit strategy with dates right now, but I would appreciate the government to be clear about how it intends to relieve people from this. And I think communication into the failings of their economic support would be beneficial, rather than simply pretending that those hoops that people are falling through simply don't exist. I mean, obviously a government is meant to assure itself that at a time of national crisis like this, I think what people are seeking most is some form of feeling that there is discussion going on and that they are not being forgotten about.
Yeah, I mean, before we get to others on this, in terms of an exit strategy, why do you think that's so important? Is it so that it shows people that there's light at the end of the tunnel and helps people's mental health in terms of carrying on through this virus? Is that why you're concerned about the exit strategy?
I think the exit strategy is important. I'm not expecting government to clamp down on anything, and I'm aware that the date will likely have to be extended. I think this could go on potentially until July, even August, September in a worst-case scenario. Not with all of the restrictions, but I feel as though the government explained that there was a method by which they were using to both return people to work and to handle people who are still going to work and feel unsafe seeing family and relatives would be very useful. So, for example, people are unsure and there are some questions to be answered about people who are still expecting family members to work, which the government would do well to answer. So it doesn't just concern nexus strategy, but rather the government's information feels almost as though it's too vague as it stands right now.
Okay, let's go to Francesca and then Nathan, because I think they both want to come in.
I was going to say, I think it's quite a bad idea if we publish an exit strategy before we have the information and the ability to properly develop one. Once you put information out there, people are going to sort of act on it. It's going to be in people's minds, and I think it's unfair on the government to have to put out information that they feel they'll be held to. I also think that while we do need some degree of information, I think we do have a good amount, and I think it's unfair to sort of put too much pressure on the government to sort of put on a show almost for the public. I think it's far more important that they focus on their strategy, and I don't understand, they can't give us information that they don't have.
Okay, let's go to Nathan. Nathan, what are your thoughts?
I was just going to say that I don't think at this current point in time criticism of no exit strategy is all that valid, because I think the exit strategy is going to be heavily related to lifting the lockdown, and lifting the lockdown, again, as has been said, is going to rely on a lot of data being collected, whether it's through the NHS app or through surveying, because you're going to have to gradually release certain demographics to different at different times. So I think in the very near future, an exit strategy will be needed and perhaps expected. But I think at this point in time, I don't think it's necessarily valid to criticise the government for not having one.
Okay, let's go to Harry. Harry, what are your thoughts about, well, the exit strategy, which seems to be a point of contention, and then also the question of whether Dominic Raab should be given more authority in the cabinet to lead the response?
I think in terms of the exit strategy, the reason why a formal exit strategy has not been announced by the government as of yet is because we are still going through the peak. And I think we're going to go for the peak this week again. And then what the government will do, they'll have a 2-week whether the lockdown will still continue. Because I believe if they announce a lockdown, almost, you know, we're nearly there. And we're not nearly there. You know, I don't want to sugarcoat it at all. We've still got a long way to go fighting COVID-19. And I don't think it's appropriate to release an exit strategy as of yet, because I think first of all it would get a lot of the public complacent, because we still need the public to work very hard in terms of social distancing and make sure that we reduce the spread as much as possible. But I think another point that I really would like to make is, because we've not released an exit strategy as of yet, is because every day information and the data is changing. So one of the main issues at the moment is a vaccine is many months off, so we can't take that into consideration yet in terms of vaccine. There's been the idea of herd immunity, so if you've already caught the COVID-19, can you catch it again? That's not categorical yet. We don't know that for sure. So in terms of an exit strategy, I do not want to release an exit strategy in which it's half-hearted and 100% of it is not true. There's still a lot of information and a lot of data, as someone clearly pointed out, that we've got to figure out first. So in terms of the NHS app, it's really important that it's got accountability to it. So when the government are tracking your location, if you have got symptoms of the virus or if you have been tested positive for the virus, it's important to know who has the oversight and who has the accountability to make sure that there's not an abuse of power by the government. In terms of Dominic Raab being given more power as First Secretary, well, I think it's appropriate to say, first of all, I wish the Prime Minister the very best and wish him a speedy recovery from the virus. But in terms of Dominic Raab, is I think he came out the other day in a press briefing saying he has all the necessary power to ensure that the UK government is being run and run effectively. But it also was confirmed the other day by Number 10 that he has the power for military action as well. So I'm very confident he has the power to make the relative decisions in terms of the COVID-19 response. But as Francesca correctly pointed out, he will have to work with his cabinet on many things. I don't agree with Francesca in terms of the whole cabinet's equal. That's incorrect. I think there will be certain people in there who will have more say than others. So the Chancellor and the Health Secretary would have more say than the Media Secretary, for example. So I think Dominic Raab's got the power. But in terms of an exit strategy, I think we've just got to be patient. I think we've got to wait for it to make sure the exit strategy that we're releasing is factually accurate, to ensure that we do go on to save lives and to ensure that this pandemic is not repeated, and to make sure that the British public is not complacent, because we've got a long, big job to go still.
Okay, right, we're going to move on now. We've got around 10 minutes left. So we're going to move on to the actual problem of, well, where the virus actually started, and the actual discussion of meat, wildlife trade and these markets. So I think we'll start off with William here. So, William, Ricky Gervais, a celebrity, has brought attention online to the problem of the continued operation of wet markets. So, for example, they're still selling bats and snakes and dogs in Indonesia and in parts of China. Once they declared victory over the virus, these meat markets once again opened. So what do you think the international community is going to have to do once we're further down the line in terms of clamping down on this wildlife trade and its consumption?
Well, I think the first things first is to consider the fact that wet markets, there are studies still going into the extent to which these wet markets are contributing to spread of the virus, the extent to which these wildlife do pose a risk, many people view that this wildlife is their natural form of income, and simply shutting down the markets permanently would leave millions unemployed. I'm not for a moment suggesting that we should keep these markets open and allow the spread of the virus. I think for now they should be closed, and I think the international community should put considerable pressure on the governments of countries like Indonesia, Vietnam, and other countries and regions where wet markets are common to be very careful about the extent and hygienic regulations employed in these areas, many of which are very rural. But I also think there's a large question of the fact that we do not know the science as of yet, and we cannot for yet create any concrete distinction as to how much of a risk these wet markets pose. So any action as to a permanent closure of these wet markets or permanent new regulations would have to come with particular scientific backing. I think, for example, the fact that these wet markets have operated for a long period of time and to many people is just a natural way of life in these communities does suggest that what has happened here with this supposedly coming from pangolins has been something of considerable So I think for now it's too soon to take any rash actions or decisions as of yet. Not that I'm encouraging complaints.
Yeah. I mean, William, do you think maybe celebrities such as Ricky Gervais or those who are advocating closing them would say that it's better to urge on the side of caution and close them if it's suspected that they are the origin of the virus? And also, on the larger point, going back to your point, how do you think that we can get countries such as, you mentioned Vietnam, you mentioned Indonesia, how can we get them to close markets if it comes out that they are the source of the virus when they have a positive economic impact upon their communities?
Well, I think to start as the economic impact they provide for their communities, if these governments who are acting as rational actors realise that they do contribute and potentially act as spreads of disease that can kill most of their own people, will in most places agree to close the businesses temporarily, at least, to be able to contain the spread of these viruses. These countries are acting rationally, as it stands right now in my belief, of in some cases placing some regulations upon them, but not closing them down entirely, because I feel if you apply wet markets as the epicentre and global spread of the virus entirely, that opens up a whole new series of questions about wildlife consumption in rural and developing countries. Wet markets are merely coalitions of people in large areas together, but that also applies in countries throughout sub-Saharan Africa. It applies throughout all of Asia, essentially. So questions have to be levied as to the extent these restrictions are going to be applied and the implications of those restrictions entirely.
Okay, thank you. Let's go to Harry on this topic. Harry, what are your thoughts about these wet markets?
I agree with what Labour are saying here, because first of all, we need to have the evidence and we need to have an investigation once the pandemic is over to see where the origin of the virus is from, but to see what happened and why it happened and how to improve it. I don't think it's appropriate at this current moment to be pointing the finger of blame at anyone. I think we've got to focus on making sure that we recover from this and then we hold the appropriate investigations. But in terms, if there is an investigation and the investigation concludes that wet markets was the origin of the virus, I think Britain has to use first of all its hegemonic power to try and influence other countries, as well as other countries following suit, such as the United States, America and Japan. But I also think we can play a large part in terms of our international aid budget. So I know for the other day we were allocated £200 million to our foreign aid budget in order to help countries recover from COVID-19. So Britain and other countries certainly will have a large amount of influence in the world. We live in a global community in the world, and if loads of countries are putting certain pressures on a country or a collective amount of countries, I think we will certainly see the change which is required. But I think what is important at the moment is for rational action to be taken. So we close the wet markets because they are suspicions that they are the cause of the virus. But once the pandemic or once the spread has decreased significantly, we hold the appropriate and independent investigations to find out what happened, why it happened, who's to blame, and what we're going to do to ensure this never happens again.
Okay, and I mean, you've spoken about not jumping to conclusions. There's been reports that some Conservative backbenchers have who prior to this crisis were already against Huawei playing a role in the delivery of our 5G network. And subsequently, Huawei have sent a letter to the Prime Minister urging him not to retaliate against the company as a result of the virus. What are your thoughts on those reports?
I think Johnson first of all has to think what's happened, and he's got to. I personally think he's got to rethink the whole Huawei situation, because the reason being is in China there's not a lot of independence from the people, from the government, and if Huawei were to take control of certain infrastructure in the UK, it would pose a national security threat. But I think one of the major problems when it comes to Huawei though is, even though the UK government have held the correct investigations into Huawei to build their infrastructure, I think it sets a precedence. The UK has a reputation around the world for having one of the best security networks and security systems in the world. And if they're seeing the UK government following suit, say Huawei is safe to use, other countries will use it. And I don't think they've got the appropriate investigators, and I don't think they've got the appropriate facilities to ensure the testing is correct in terms of Huawei. And it sets a precedence to other countries around the world to follow suit. So I think we certainly need to have a review at the end of this pandemic about the whole Huawei situation.
Okay, let's move on to Nathan now. Sorry, Francesca, did you want to come in there?
Oh no, I was going to say, while I get caution, I think we definitely do need to sort of point the finger now. Because while we don't have definitive proof of the role of wet markets in the sort of spread and creation of the virus, we do have proof that the CCP have lied about this. And that was the defining factor. The CCP sort of covered it up for a couple of months, allowing it to go into general transmission. And they also lied to the WHO and explicitly told nations to sort of not take place, not to cancel flights, ensuring that it spread throughout the world. While we think, well, I completely understand why you might want to wait after, China's already beginning sort of a propaganda operation to deflect blame from themselves. And I think it's very important to counter that so that nations and governments have the support they need to call China out on this.
I mean, Francesca, on that point, Michael Gove has said that some of the reporting from China was not clear about the scale, the nature, the infectiousness of this. What do you make of those comments?
I think that's absolutely true. I mean, dissidents were saying since the start that the death rates were far, far higher. And there were doctors reporting to Chinese dissidents that in places where the CCP said there were no confirmed cases, that they had about 15, 20 people in their hospital alone with it. And there have even been concerns. I think this is where the lab conspiracy started, and people from the lab in Wuhan have gone missing. Now, I don't believe it was made there, but I do think that the CCP asked scientists to confirm it and then sort of made people disappear when they tried to whistleblow. And I think that's very, very important. And I think we need to keep it in mind, because the Chinese government absolutely have weaponized this and have, I believe, deliberately allowed it to spread so that other countries suffer economically and they don't lose their economic footing too much.
Okay, let's bring Nathan in on this. Nathan, apparently there are officials within the government, and of course this is only speculation, but according to the Business Insider, have said that Beijing should face a reckoning. What do you make of these reports?
Well, I must say I completely agree. China has played a massive role in the current fallout with the virus. Firstly, just quickly in relation to wet markets, this is not the first virus we have seen emerge from Chinese regions where wet markets are highly prominent. We had SARS, we had Asian flu, and now we've got COVID-19. So whilst, yes, closing down wet markets might have an immediate economic impact on the people that work there, if in the long run, you're going to be hopefully decreasing the number of global viruses that come out of them. But also China's handling in relation to the WHO. It was Taiwan that tried to alert the WHO and the rest of the world that China was facing issues with a virus, but because China contributes large funding to the WHO, and the fact that the WHO doesn't actually recognize Taiwan, or China's blocked Taiwan's access to the body, these reports were completely disregarded and has led...
Yeah, okay. But Nathan, what would you... How would you respond to Harry and William's thoughts about you can't jump to conclusions when we don't have all the evidence in front of us?
Well, no, I'm not talking about the immediate closure of wet markets, and I do certainly agree with that, but I think it's very hard for anyone to deny China not having a role in the outcome we find ourselves in.
Okay. We've reached the hour mark. Does anyone else have anything to say about the topic of China and the wet markets?
I just like to intervene on the point of the WHO. The WHO, I completely agree with the idea that the WHO sort of contributed to this as well. And I think we need to see some sort of reform of the WHO where they test independently and don't just trust what sort of nations say. Because in this case, it led to, the spread of the virus and prevented nations from taking action.
Okay. Well, yeah, you can come in, yeah.
I was just mentioning that in terms of China deliberately spreading this virus to essentially improve its power and its global rivals in disarray, I think that doesn't really make sense. I'm not defending China. I think it's an awful country. But it relies upon global to maintain its growth. And I think the idea that it would cause a complete global shutdown of flights and trade, essentially, between nations, and a complete shutdown of its consumer-based growth feels a bit illogical. I think what's really happened here is there's been incompetence in the part of the CCC, and what has happened now is, in their attempts to cover up this virus and attempt to essentially keep its markets open and create and prevent panic amongst investors in Beijing, they have allowed this global virus to grow. I think there should be some form of response to this.
Okay. Well, thank you, everyone. I think we've reached the hour mark, so I think we're gonna leave it there. But thank you all for taking the time to give your thoughts on all these really important topics.